Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Stephen the Warman Rice Kickfighting Podcast Show. I'm your host, Stephen the Warman. You can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/StephenTheWarman, one word. And you, most importantly, are listening to this podcast in one of two ways. You are either at the blog, which is lordgaul.podbean.com. I usually upload that weekly, put it on my weekly or biweekly, and I put it up on the Twitterverse. And also, the most effective way, the most efficient way to get the show is to enter Warman Kickfighting Show into your iTunes search engine, either Warman Kickfighting Show or Lord Gaul, because Lord Gaul was my username back when I first fell in love with the sport in the early 2000s. So that's when I was on K1 USA and Kakutugi and, you know, K1 fans and all that. So gonna go ahead and jump into the show. Got a pretty big show, a lot of things going on. Nothing bigger than the fact that, even bigger than the fact of who actually won the fight, won the tournament. Bukau loses in the Top King finale. It was a tournament that kind of took place over like 6 months, and the final night was supposed to be a four-night tournament. It had some really good fights, some breakout stars and so on, but all of the talk is about Bukau Benjamin's loss to Gahal, I'm going to make sure I'm pronouncing his name right, Dzhaniv. I'm pretty sure it's pronounced as Dzhaniv. At least the commentary was kind of pronouncing it close to that. But Dzhaniv gets the victory over Bukau. And here's kind of how the fight happened. For most of you guys have seen it. For those who didn't, the first round was the telling round. Bukau has, for a very long time, for I'd say the majority of his career, he has a habit of avoiding offense by, I won't even say it's a slip necessarily. It's just kind of more ducking. He'll extend his left hand, he'll put his right hand to his head, and then he'll just duck when shots come at him. When this happened, the start, Dzhaniv's start was so aggressive, he got in his face, he threw a lot of power 3-2s and a lot of power 3 elbows, where he threw his slicing left elbow, and he just kept doing it and got right in his face. He cut Bukau pretty early, and you could see that Bukau was a mess. You could see the blood all over him. Bukau just kind of, powered through, and then they stopped to go look at it because it was as good a start as you could possibly have. And Bukau's defense was the same. He'd always dip off to the side, and that elbow would always find him. That southpaw elbow of Dzhaniv would always help or score and find the mark. So he continued to put the pressure on, continued to score offense, more aggressive with his hands. Kicked every once in a while, but mostly it was a barrage of strong hand combos, 1-2-3s, 3-2s, 3 elbows, as I was mentioning before. It's pretty much, walk him down, posting with his, lead right hand and then firing elbow. Like, it was just consistent offense, where Bukau would just simply duck or then kind of reach in for like a clinch until he got separation and didn't really get the clean kickboxing flow. With his kicks, with his distance game, that kind of opened up his bigger shots with his hands. Round one ends, and round two begins, and Bukau shows that heart, that grit, that thing that makes him a special fighter. He didn't bow down or back down once he started to get the cuts, he started to bleed. He started to pick up the work with the knees. He started to score a lot of step-up knees, and Dzhaniv spent a lot of the round walking into straight knees, walking into step-up knees, being pushed to the side, being like walked down as he kind of just had both of his arms protecting his body because he'd eaten so many knees. Bukau had come back in that portion of the fight. Then you get to the third round. In the third round, Bukau wasn't scoring as clean as he did in the second round. And as his first kind of comeback round, he kind of slowed down. Dzhaniv was able to score another elbow. They looked at, the cut of Bukau again. Bukau kind of went back in there. That third round was kind of like ho-hum. You can make the argument that Bukau maybe won the third round. Dzhaniv still scored another big elbow. That was the most significant shot in that round, I would say. So when the cards came in and Dzhaniv had done enough to hold off Bukau, I mean, they celebrated like they'd won the championship. Like, it really was a big time victory, even at this stage of Bukau's career as he heads into his middle, mid-30s. I think he's 32, 33 right now. As he moves into that stage, like, people are looking at him. You could see that he's, older in his face. You could see that he isn't what he was when he was he won his first K1 World Grand Prix Championship more than, if it's 2015 right now, he won it more than 10, 11 years ago for the first one. So it's like, I was thinking, I got questions on Twitter, is he at the end? I've seen write-ups about how this is the death of Bukau and so on. And first of all, the first thing that I want to establish is this. Glory or K-1 or whoever, those two, Glory in particular, it shows how popular Bukau is still in the kickboxing universe, in kickboxing and Muay Thai universe, kickfighting universe. It shows how popular he is that when he loses, so many people respond. In the last 3-4 years of me watching kickboxing and Muay Thai, the three most talked about losses, I'd say, Bukau walking out on the K-1 World Grand Prix last year with the Enrique Kiel, that got crazy talk on Twitter and online. This loss against Zaniv, and then the loss of Cyborg when she lost to Irina Byers. When I looked online, so many people had commented on it. So many people had words for it. It just shows how big Bukau is as a figure in kickboxing. Other people have lost. Like, even when Petrosian lost to Andy Ristie, it didn't get the kind of recognition that Bukau was getting for losing today. It probably should have, you know what I'm saying? Because Bukau is, I mean, Petrosian's amazing. He had a longer streak of not losing and so on. But I don't think he ever, he captures the, Petrosian captures the imagination of the purists who really appreciate his technical work and his high level skill set. But he never, you know, kind of captured the hearts of those who were watching the fight sport. He was just kind of that thing that you brag about because you know who Petrosian is. But really, when Petrosian fight came up, sometimes people don't even, you know, a lot of those Italy fights, people don't put in the work to kind of YouTube those up and watch those fights and so on, because he's usually so one-sided in his defense, it looks like all of his fights are the same. He didn't get what Bukau or any of the K-1, you know, Max guys who kind of came from that 2003 to 2008 era, those guys in that kind of gap, they still kind of resonate with people today. And Bukau is probably, and I say this all the time, and some people will probably be against it, but I'm going to say it anyways, Bukau is the he's the most popular international fighter out of Thailand of my lifetime, and I think of all time. Like, he is the most known. Like, he can go to different venues all over the world, and there will be a pop for him. And people appreciate some of the champions that came before him, and there are definitely way better people in the stadiums. Bukau did not have a great stadium run. When he got to Lumpini, I think he went 0-3-1. But, like, his style, his charisma, the swag, if you want to use that, like just the way that he did things, the way that he performed, even his Y crew. Like, I remember in Japan, I watched him fight in Japan too, but it's when I watched him fight in Jamaica, Champions versus Champions 2. He is performing his Y crew in front of a bunch of Jamaican fans that have absolutely no idea what a Y crew is. All they know is he's doing it before the fight starts. But the way he's doing it is so technically beautiful that the crowd applauds after they watch it. Bukau is a figure in this sport, and it is important that he continues to fight not just high-level opposition, but he's got to fight in a place where he can be recognized. This loss, the problem with this loss is it didn't happen in Glory. You know, it didn't happen to a guy. There needs to be a handing over the torch type of moment. You know, Andy Ristie is probably going to be one of the first guys who are in a generation of fighters that come after after K-1 and they become internationally known kickboxers. Robin van Roosmalen, same thing. He didn't get a K-1 opportunity. Like, the Glory's got to start grooming their own brand of, you know, Nicky Holtzkin's already on his way. People recognize these guys as the stars, as the elite fighters in the world. That's the direction that they have to go in. And Bukau losing to, you know, Zaniv, I've been messing this name up already, but Kayal is just not as cool as saying his last name, Dzaniv. He won this fight, and I'm telling you, just to give you a hint, when I was watching the other fights on this card, the guy who actually gets credit for winning this tournament, Reese McAllister, when I watched his video, the YouTube views were around 300 or 400 by themselves. Bukau has got like 6 or 7 versions out there of his fight with Dzaniv, and in those versions, they're all around 40,000, 30,000, 35,000 views, and that's because Bukau is the name and Reese McAllister the winner. The difference between to have 7 different like versions of your video on YouTube get 30,000 plus views, meaning that you're in the hundreds of thousands of views, and the winner is under 500, the winner of the tournament's under 500, shows that you got to have these guys fight each other. You got to have these guys fight on a bigger platform. you got to have a Bukau fight and win and lose on a huge stage. It matters to people. People will still get a hold of the video, but it matters because of who he is and his history that he's fighting at the highest level. So hopefully they pursue Bukau to glory, maybe give him like a starter fight or whatever. But even if he were to fight Sitichai and lose, if he fought Sitichai in glory and lose, people could be like, okay, Sitichai is the next Thai that you need to be watching. Because really, their careers are going in two different directions. Bukau's a little bit older. Sitichai on the rise is to be the next kind of big star. But man, I really think that Bukau, skill set wise, is still a guy who is a top 10 talent in kickboxing in the world. Like, he could still win over a lot of guys in the top 10. His skill set, even though his resume isn't quite there yet, his skill set still belongs there. He can still do really well. Even though he lost Enrico Kiel, the time that he fought Enrico Kiel before they had that draw and he walked out, when he met him, the time before that, and when they fought in, you know, full Thai rules, but it was like, you know, Max Muay Thai, it was an absolute slaughter job. It's one of those things where I was like, I cannot believe how good Bukau still is. He is still a very talented fighter. So, is he what he was 10 years ago? No. But is he still an awesome fighter? Yes. So, for those who ask the question, is he in decline? For those who are doing the write-ups on this is the end of Bukau, I couldn't disagree with you more. I still think that there are a lot of big wins that he could have. And this isn't boxing where you lose and it's the, you know, the sky is falling. This is the Muay Thai kickboxing world. But Kyle spent years of his career where he would go to, I think the thing that made him probably the most famous was when he fought and he won the K-1 World Grand Prix. He was the first guy to really show that title meant you were the best kickboxer in the world at that weight. Masato, when he won it, Masato still stayed at home for the most part. Like, he just fought in Japan. When Bukau won the K-1 World Grand Prix, he then went out and fought some of the best fighters that weren't in the organization. So I remember there was a period of time where Jamad had a championship, and he had been, you know, still older. Jamad's still older. And he said that he wanted to fight Bukau because Bukau had this name and so on. And Bukau obliged him, fought him, stopped him in the second round. There was I won't say the argument, but one of the fighters that really showed a lot of good skill set kind of in that, you know, early 2000s area, you know, coming out of France was Farid Valoum. And Farid Valoum and Bukau fought, and Bukau beat him. Like, it's just those kind of fights were out there, and they were in full Thai rules, and he would fight these guys who were still out in the outskirts, making a name for themselves. He would then leave the K-1, go fight these guys, and then go back to K-1 and still beat the elite. So people would recognize that title as the best because Bukau kept going out and beating any of the best who were out there. This is the name that this guy brings to the sport. He was hurt, I'd say, in this fight by some of the decisions and the fights that he's taking outside of bigger organizations. The thing with Thai Fight, when it first came together, I've said this many times in the show before, the first tournament field that they put together that had Liam Harrison and, the Fabio Pinto, who ended up winning that first tournament, I was like, Thai Fight is about to be the next big thing. And then they got Bukau. And then Bukau's first tournament, there were some good names in there. Abraham Aquini's name was in there. He had some good opposition in terms of names that people would recognize in that first round of a tournament. Then it became, let's see these high-level Thai guys destroy these not-so-good guys. And that's kind of what the brand is today, and that's why I stopped reporting on the Thai fights. Like, I just said, hey, they're good to do what they do, but that isn't what I want to do. I want to do international kickboxing and Muay Thai. If you just pick somebody who's training in Thailand and just go in and lose to your elite, I don't think that that represents the sport in a way where I'm like, okay, I'm going to, you know, show this, or I'm going to break this down in my podcast. I see that more so as a show that they're putting on. That's why they don't have gloves anymore. They've got, you know, ropes in their hands and that kind of stuff. When Bukau went to their organization, he was still fighting a few good people in the beginning, and then they just started giving him guys that he was supposed to slaughter. And when he went through that series of time, he was so used to just walking through people's offense. I remember I had Ryan Scalia back when he was big into Muay Thai and kickboxing, back when he and I used to do the podcast. He would come on and he said that it seems like Bukau is neglecting his defense. And really, because he had opposition that couldn't do anything, he was. He just walked through everything that you do. He just walked through all your offense, all of his Thai fight career. He's just walking through those guys' punches, ducking, coming back with his own offense, and he's stopping them. So everybody gets what they want. Nobody cares. He'd spent 2 years of his life training himself how not to beat elite guys. Because you can't walk through the punches of Andy Ristie. You can't walk through the punches of Georgia Petrosian, Robert Van Roosmalen. You got to have some defense. And Bukau used to be a guy who was at least slick enough to lean back out of the way. When was the last time you seen Bukau really lean out of the way of big power shots like he used to do? There's that little video that he had when he was in K1. Now he just kind of puts that left arm out, puts his right hand at his head, and then he ducks. And this time, Dzani figured it out, scored really well, was able to get the victory. Now that Bukau's lost, can Bukau still beat high-level fighters? Yes, Bukau can beat Dzani. If they fought again, I'd be like, Bukau's going to win. I thought Dzani had a really good shot. He's a good athlete. Don't be fooled by these records. I'll get into that in a little bit. But man, Bukau is still an elite name in this sport. He's still a high-level fighter. Don't go thinking that his career is over because of this one loss. He is still a very good fighter that people want to see. As for the winner, Khiel Dzani, he did himself a disservice by not fighting in the final. He won the fight. People were talking about, oh, Bukau lost to a guy with 13 fights. Don't be fooled by the record of anybody who fights in the Eastern European, you know, like that in Russia, like that part, you know, Ukraine. Don't be fooled by the records. Those guys fight in the IFMAs. Those guys fight in the European Championships. They might not have a bunch of pro fights on their resume, but they got a bunch of fights on their resume. Because they, I mean, even one of the breakdowns of Dmitro Konstantinov, the guy who fought Reese McAllister in the other fight of the semifinal, that guy, it showed that he had like a few fights, and then it said, IFMA championship, and it's showing it. And those are like weak tournaments, you know what I'm saying? You're fighting four or five times in those, you know, and I'm like, because they're not pros, they're not putting him down. But this guy is not just some novice that they found off the street. He's not the guys that they bring in, not all the guys, but most of the guys that they bring in the Thai fight lately. He doesn't have their kind of resume. This dude comes in with a pretty legit resume. He just doesn't have the pro fights that some of the other guys have. And he was able to put on a good show. If he had went out there and fought in the final, it would have really done him just a service, because they would be like, this is the dude to watch. 154 pounds, this guy came in and won the tournament. He is beat Bukau. He is going to be one of the next stars. People would be focusing on him in that way. But because he was injured thanks to, you know, Bukau's effort, and he didn't even go out there and, like, you know, die in his sword, I think part of him wanted to just like, hey, if I'm going to lose, I'm going to lose going home with Bukau, you know, Bukau name on my resume. I want to come, get that win, and I probably won't beat Reese McAllister, but I'm not going to give Reese McAllister the honor of beating me, even though I'm wounded. I'm out of here. That's kind of how it felt. I'm not sure that saying that that's true, because clearly he could have legitimately been injured. He could have legitimately been in a place where Bukau had taken something out of him, and he couldn't perform in that last fight. But it would have been to his service to go on there and try. Because if he had got these two wins, people would be talking more about Dzaniev being one of the future stars in kickboxing than they are about Bukau. Not as much. Still, Bukau lost would have mattered more. But he would have been somebody that you were excited to see moving forward. When he didn't go out there, and a name that we've heard before, just haven't heard a lot, wins the tournament, it does change the game a little bit. Going to said person, Reese McAllister has been putting in the work. He had a great run. He's got, you know, got KO stoppage in this tournament run. He really put on a clinic against Dmitry Konstantinov. Konstantinov, he fought like he didn't really know what he was going to do. There'd be a period of time where he'd walk Reese McAllister down, because Reese McAllister spent the first two rounds with his back to the rope. And Dmitry walked him down, and he'd throw a combination here and there. But once he got there, didn't really seem comfortable with his kicks, didn't really seem comfortable with his offense. And Reese McAllister went to work on those low kicks. Really started to score well, started to step this right, would always chop, simple combination chop, counter Dmitry offensive onslaught, and then chop the low kick. He got the low kick work going. Second round, didn't come back to it early, kind of paced himself, scored it with his boxing, kept his back. Dmitry had a few moments where he tried like a jumping knee or a jumping elbow over the top to get the crowd to woo. He did one really cool one where he did like a spinning back kick, and then Reese McAllister leaned out of the way and then fired a low kick right after. It was super slick to watch because it happened so quick. Round three, Reese McAllister did what every coach in the world that, you know, coaches someone in kickboxing and Muay Thai boxing, MMA. If you are having the advantage over somebody in two rounds, I want you to take it to him in round three. Let's try to get him out of there. And Reese realized, this guy's not giving me any offensive adversity or any offensive diversity. He's not scoring consistently. He doesn't have a consistent attack. He just walks in front of me and stands there. I'm going to let him go. So after you've been figured out, Reese McAllister is coming after you. He's letting his hands go, and Demetrio had nothing for him. As soon as the flurry of hands kind of came into play, uppercut in the series, I want to say it was an uppercut, or it was right hand for sure, it drops Demetrio. Demetrio gets up, and still, he's getting beaten. He's trying to get out of the round. Reese McAllister is hunting him down, looking to score with, you know, step-up knees, trying to bring him to the head. More than anything, he's really trying to let the boxing go and trying to get the stoppage. Demetrio Konstantinov was able to get out of the fight, and Reese McAllister gets the W. And after that, the only thing he needs is cemented is just the one more fight, because he was in great shape. He didn't take any real damage in the fight. And then, of course, it's disappointing when you hear that you win by forfeit. But at the same time, you put the work in. You put the work in. You did the running. You did the tie pad work. You did the sparring rounds. You won the fights to get you into this position. Reese McAllister is your top king champion, and he wouldn't have been one of the names that anybody would have picked to emerge from this group. Murat Grigoryan was one of the names that was in this group once upon a time. That just shows the level of skill that you had. This was a solid tournament field. This was not no bum field put together. There were some good names, some good international talents. These guys earned their way to the spot. It's anticlimactic because for the second year in a row in kickboxing and Muay Thai, there's an international tournament, K1 last year, Top King this year, that ends the final fight on some sort of DQ or forfeit or something other than somebody winning and earning a fight over a, you know, stopping a guy or getting a decision. It's never good if that happens. But Reese McAllister, you did the work. You're one of the new stars in this sport. You just got to get, Glory's got to put like an 8-man tournament together. You got to get that kind of recognition because you've had those opportunities before. A lot of people thought that you beat Mike Zambides when they did the K1 World Grand Prix in Greece. I thought you performed really well that day. We just need to see more of Reese McAllister because he's growing all the time in his Muay Thai and in his kickboxing skill set. This guy's legit, so we got to get more of him competing on a high level. Hopefully Japan, because they haven't done a, you know, 8-man tournament in a while. We've got the big Dynamite show coming up. Maybe when they go there, Reese McAllister can be a part of an 8-man tournament field, and that would be really, really good for the kickboxing world. But we'll end it on the note of Reese McAllister is a star to pay attention to, and he is your Top King 154-pound champion. Going to go ahead and look at some of the fights leading into it. Bokorn gets a victory over Dmitry Vratz, and Vratz is literally looked like he was like 3 weight classes bigger than Bokorn. It wasn't one of Bokorn's better performances because of how big Dmitry was. I thought that he was really conservative the first round. He'd score like body kick here, he'd score a punch here and there, got into the clinch. Vratz just kind of walked him down. But in round two, Bokorn let the offense go a lot more. He'd kick and then he'd move to the side. He'd catch Vratz, kick and return. He got a dump in the tie clinch. He was able to score, single shots here and there, double here and there. Wasn't able to put together the offense he scored before. Wasn't able to land the big left hook that gets people in trouble. I thought that Bokorn did a really good job of getting a clean win. It just wasn't the most exciting win, especially not coming from him because he's a very talented fighter. So shout out to Bokorn. I like that you're getting international opportunities. This was a win for you, but you've looked better in other fights. Vratz, I don't know what your weight class is, but you look like you're a monster next to Bokorn, and we'll see something coming from you in the future. Runger V. Sasiprapa destroys the outside leg of Wei Ning Hu. And here goes one of my things. I've heard people say this before. I don't know why people feel it's true. For whatever reason, maybe it's because you're kind of going at their power hand, but I know that there are coaches out there who feel and are coaching that it's not good for you to go at the back leg of an opponent if they have an opposite stance to you. So what I mean by that is this. If I'm right-handed and you're left-handed, it's not a good idea for you, the left-hander, to go at my back rear leg, being my right leg, or me, the right-hander, going at your back leg, your rear left leg. That is ridiculous. If you're out there coaching that, you're dead wrong. And Runger V says you're wrong. He's one of many examples of how this happens. All you have to do is score and know that your leg can reach a guy's back leg. It's just you've got to make sure that you distract enough to get to that back leg. So usually people are going to go jab to the outside leg, or they're going to throw a hook so that they can do like a small skip step and then chop over to your back leg. You can get to that leg fine. And then the worst thing is most people aren't used to defending that leg. So they don't know necessarily how to pick up a check there. It's not that it's something that they don't know, but in the heat of the fight, you're getting attacked in an area that you're not used to. You don't have a defense for it. A good example would be, for those of you who've watched Rico Verheeren has a really weird kick where he'll throw a jab, move his body weight from the middle of you to the left foot, kind of even with your back leg, and then he'll throw a power leg kick to your inside rear leg, which is very, very rare for somebody to score. You're in your normal stance and somebody hits you in the inside leg of your back leg. That's not something that you see a lot. But because he knows the angling of his body, he can get that kick in there without kicking your lead leg. That's because that would be the obstacle that you would get in your way. He's got that kick down. And the way that he has that kick down, it's even easier for Ronger V to score and pick an angle where he can chop his big left leg to attack Wing-Ning Hu's back leg, and he chopped it up. It got to the point where Ronger V, I would say he had scored it so much that he kind of did that. You know how Thais have that mutual agreement that we're going to go ahead and end the fight? Round three was like the longest round in the world for Wing-Ning Hu, and Ronger V was slowing it down, giving him his opportunity to score his offense, kind of hanging out, letting him do his thing, giving him the opportunity to get out of the round, and the round just seemed forever, so he just kept chopping the leg. I can't tell you how many low kicks he scored, but the effect of the low kicks is what you want. Wing-Ning Hu, even though he didn't have the fell on the ground thanks to the low kicks, he threw no offense for two rounds. All he did was get kicked and try to walk away from getting kicked. He didn't bite down any punches. He had a great start. Wing-Ning Hu probably won the first round. He had moments where he bit down his mouthpiece, threw combinations in fives and sixes, and he scored well against Ronger V, who was just on chill mode for the whole first round. Wing-Ning Hu scored combinations upstairs. He was digging to the body because Ronger V kind of joked about, like, oh man, that body shot kind of came around. He kind of rubbed in that spot. So Wing-Ning Hu kept going back to it. He just kept saying, hey, I'm going to go punch you in that spot again. I don't care if you think it's cute to pretend like, oh, it wasn't that good of a score. I'm going to keep scoring there. He had a great start, but after those tools were taken away when that leg got chopped, he just waited the round out. And the end of the fight, literally, there's a period of time where Ronger V reached out and grabbed both of Wing-Ning's hands and then kind of put a pop shot right through the middle. Like, he extended both of his hands, pop shot through the middle. Pop teep here and there. Just, he really clowned him for like the last 40 seconds of the fight, just moving in slow motion. Not throw anything hard. He knew he had it in the bag. Ronger V. Sasiprapa is just a completely different fighter from the guy. He was so aggressive back in the day. He used to come forward and so on. And then all of a sudden, he decided that, you know, he's going to change it up because that's getting him hit a little bit more than he wants. And he's got more skill than that. So he can slow it down and start to score clean here and there. There was just a period of time where I believe that he said, you know what, it's time to change this up. And he's looked great ever since he's done it. So shout out to Ronger V. Matt Embry gets a TKO over Sidisak. And it's just one of the fights I wasn't able to see. But Matt Embry is a regular. This event took place in Hong Kong. Matt Embry and his team, CM1 and Toronto, they fight in China quite a bit. So it's good that he got down there. He got another victory. He's still a talented guy. You know, he's got the split, of course, with... I don't know if they're 1-1 or if they fought three times. But I know they fought twice for sure on Lion Fight anyways with Kevin Ross. I really like that he put on a good performance and he was able to get the stoppage. And I definitely want to see more Matt Embry on the international stage. Fong Chai, Sitsong Pingyong gets a KO over Colin Law. Again, I wasn't able to. It was in the extra round, so it was close going into that. I wasn't able to see any of this fight. But Fong Chai getting the victory. Another Thai getting international opportunities. Always big. Gonna go ahead and go into some news as we leave the Top King promotion, which, you know, really, really good stuff, good fights, really, really enjoyed it. But we're gonna go into the news that happened earlier this week that's turned into a Twitter war, like, you know, after 2 days of news, it's now a Twitter war, which is very entertaining. But we are gonna go to the news that Gokhan Saki is stripped of his light heavyweight championship. And the news earlier today is that Zach Mokasa is going to be fighting Salo Calavari for the title. And my views on it are simple. I really truly believe that Gokhan Saki is one of the best fighters in the world, and he's one of the best names in the world. He is, people recognize him internationally. He's a very talented guy. I want to see him fighting all the time. I would pick him to beat Cavallari or Mukasa. He's super talented. He's everything that you'd want in a champion. The problem is he has been spending a lot of time in Dubai. So he's getting around a lot of rich guys who can put on shows, and even if people don't come to the show the way that he wants, those guys can pay him the way that he wants. And him, Tyrone Spong, they are looking for those K-1 level paychecks, those big paychecks. They feel that's their value. They've been fighting the sport for a long time. They've got, 80 to 120 fights. They're kind of in that range. And they're like, hey, I want my value in the sport that I do. And my value, everyone's value isn't based off of what they think that they deserve. It's based off what they've been paid for what they've done. So if you have a history of somebody gave me a six-figure check to do this, I'm looking for six-figure checks to do this. And I'm not sure what his contract was or what he got paid when he was in Glory, or excuse me, when he was in K1. All I know is it got paid enough for Gokhan Saki to be like, you know what? I want to get paid somewhat close to this. Tyrone Spong the same. I got paid when I was out there. I want to get paid somewhat close to this. He is not wrong to take the stance that he's taking. I know a lot of people are upset about this because they want him to fight whatever. I understand him making that decision. So it's not wrong that he's feeling that way. It is also not wrong that Glory can't pay it, because Glory is trying to be a sustainable international brand, and they're focused on the USA TV deals because that's the one that brings them the most money. USA, the reason why Spike brings them the most money, it's the only one that's live. So Spike and Spike England, they show these kickboxing cards live, and the rest of the world where they get TV deals, and they've got maybe over 100 TV deals, those are played on delay. So a lot of times if you guys see Fight Club and Europe, like a lot of those fights are played on delay. Most of them are not played live. So they've got that kind of setup. The USA is the only one that's giving him pay for it in the moment. So they've got to focus on fights for that brand and pushing that brand and so on. Now, it may not be their fault necessarily, but Tyrone Spong and Gokhan Saki, in the events that they've done in the USA so far, those have been, I'll say, their lower ratings boost. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that they've both been on the same days as big boxing events. A Mayweather fight one time, Pacquiao fight another time, and a day where the combat sports world was focused on something else. Which is why when John Franklin came in and he made the brilliant decision to move them to Friday nights. That's a big move. That's a really intelligent move. And so far this year, they're slowly starting to do good numbers, find good ratings. They're finding their time slots. The only really kind of bad rating one was the one that they did from France. They were doing live, and that was in the middle of the day. Everybody's working. Of course, that one's not going to do a high rating. I thought for sure they were going to kind of do a replay of it at night here in the States, but they didn't. They just played during the day, and then you would have had to DVR it, or you weren't going to see it. The event that they had before that, when they were in, what was it? They were in California. They were in LA. And I remember that one started at like 10, and I was worried. I was like, man, 10's a late start time. I hope this one does okay. And it did. It did a pretty good number. And it's because they found a time where 10 o'clock works well, because Premier Fight League, for those who remember that, it had gone and it had done it did LA as well, and it did, well, not even LA, it kind of did something right on the outside of LA, and it did it on a Friday, and it started like 6-7, and people, because of traffic on the 10 or whatever, they couldn't get to it, and the crowd wasn't what they wanted, and the pay-per-view numbers wasn't what they wanted, and in the end, putting that much money into it, the company didn't make it. That one was kind of a hit. So these guys are like, we're going to go later at night so people have got time to get here, traffic can slow down, the nightlife crew can kind of work their way to, LA, and then we're going to go ahead and put on shows there. That's the perfect execution of this brand, of putting the sport like that. Those are the moves that Glory is making. They have those kind of insights right now. Those kind of insights for when they put their fights on and who fights on their card and what they can pay, it's all in the system of them making sure that they don't lose. Because K1, in the end, as great as K1 was in its prime and in its heyday or whatever, the crowds that they had, the emotion that they had, it may never be repeated ever in the history of kickboxing. It really may not. I hope it does, but it may not. And one of the reasons why Glory is trying to make sure that they don't do what happened to K1, who ran out of money, who couldn't pay all these big pay fighters, who had, how many people after K1 said that they're still owed money? How many people are saying that about Glory? Nobody's saying that about Glory. They're getting paid what they're getting paid, because Glory is making sure they're staying within a business model where they're not working, you know, in the negative. They're trying to keep themselves making money, keep themselves in a position. It took them a while to even have fight events that got them paid. They're doing this to the best of their ability. So I look at their side of them, I'm saying nobody's wrong here. Clearly. The fact that they're still pursuing Saki, I hope that something works out. I hope that they say, hey, maybe you go off, you fight in Dubai or whatever, 2-3 times a year, and they give you your super check. And we, as Glory, we give you a good size check, but it's more of your USA exposure check. Maybe they can work something out there. But I know as a fact that Glory is not paying these guys the money that they're asking for, not because they're trying to keep the money for themselves. It's because they're trying to have Glory be a company 5-10 years down the road. They're trying to sustain this business model. So as for the trash talk, as Zach Mikasa and Solo Calivari have been mentioned as the fights that's going to happen. Zach Mikasa is already, you know, shots fired. And I'll go ahead and run you down the Twitter tag. Shout out to Liverkick.com who posted this. I just kind of been following it online. If you're not, Zach Mikasa, his name, ZACKMWEKASSA. That's his Twitter handle. And here it is. This is to go Kansaki. I will knock your head off, then put it in the fridge. Don't even talk about me, son. That's what's Glory. Then Gokhan Sakura replies, the only thing you will knock is on the doors begging for some change after I end your career. You know, the one you don't have. Shots fired by Saki. Then we go, Mikasa, sad Gokhan Saki crying for his belt. Shame. Instagram superstar. Shots fired by Mikasa. Who are you? I don't even know who you are. Nobody does. You should be thankful and proud that I even replied and mentioned your name. Shots fired by Gokhan Saki. So those guys got to hit each other in the face one day. That's the only way this can be solved. Like, we got to have these guys fight. So I like the idea that Mikasa, who was throwing some good shots, very powerful shots, has heat in both hands, got that KO power. Him and Solo Calivari is going to be an all-action fight. Unfortunately, you know, I actually felt that a better fight for the title, and it was a close fight, it already happened, would have been him and Artem Vakhachev, you know, for Solo Calivari. I thought that that would have been the perfect time to do that title fight earlier in the year. But it shows that they were giving the Gokhan Saki thing an opportunity to turn out. They really did try to make it happen, but they really do have to stay within a certain number of what they can pay him and so on. I just think that they should try to work out, we'll pay you this number, but we'll give you the freedom to go fight for, you know, whoever, wherever, you know, go ahead and give you the freedom to fight in Dubai and get those numbers that you're going to get. But we'll do our best to keep you on, keep giving you exposure, keep giving you USA fight dates. We just can't afford those six-figure checks or whatever they were that you were getting from Glory. So I'm fine with that. I'm fine with this decision. I like the fight with Mikasa and Calivari. It's going to be in the Dynamite show September 19th for Spike. I'm really looking forward to that. We'll see what happens from this moving forward. But good light heavyweight replacement. Unfortunate situation with Saki, but I'm hoping that we work it out. And I'm hoping that he's back because he signed with another organization. He had a fight that was kind of forgettable. And now that organization doesn't even have anything scheduled for his next fight. You know, like there was that, you know, little hype that they had after the fight before with the Romanian fighter whose name eludes me just in the moment. But like that doesn't have a date that everybody's excited about seeing Gokhan Saki return at. You know, it's just out there. We want to get him back in the picture, just like we want to get Tyrone Spong back in the picture. Going to go ahead and move on to other news. I'm going to go ahead and give you another fight result. There was a big tournament. I'm going to just talk about it because Alex Pereira is doing a great job of keeping himself busy. And he, you know, I believe I'll say retains hold on, I want to make sure I get this promotion's name right because it's like, it just says World Grand Prix. It's like a Brazilian World Grand Prix thing. But he fought Cesar Almeida for the third time. And in this fight, Alex Pereira you know, scored a down, I want to say, in the third, showed a lot of good kickboxing skills. Cesar Almeida is not weak. Like, he kept coming forward. He kept finding his own offense. He kept walking Alex Pereira down. Pereira responds to the punches a little weird. Sometimes I think that he can let people just kind of let their hands go, and he kind of looks a little flimsy in his body. He doesn't like, not just in terms of the appearance of his body, but in the way that he responds when people put offense on him. He doesn't respond strong. He kind of just kind of lets it kind of go with the flow and so on. And this was a five rounder, and it looked like a five rounder. Like, Pierre was slowing in the last round and so on, but he would just have moments where he put together offense that had step up knees, hooked the low kick finishes, and he would just kind of keep that pace going, keep that pace going. But it just wasn't the fight that I guess, it wasn't the offensive output that gets a guy out of there. It's just the offensive output that gets you in the winner's circle. And I thought he did a good job of scoring consistent. I thought he did a good job of, you know, really keeping himself busy until Glory gives him that call. And this is what I want from Gokhan Saki. I'm 100% fine with him finding his paycheck in another organization. I'm hoping that he just sees it as this is an opportunity to get paid more money, not an opportunity to leave Glory altogether. That's what I'm hoping happens at the end of the Gokhan Saki situation. But clearly, financially and off their backing, they've had the most success. Glory has had their most success not focusing on paying super high prices. They've been paying reasonable prices, and, you know, we'll see what comes from that. Alex Pereira is an example of a guy who got paid okay. Still in the picture, the title picture at 187. He's a name that could be called up to fight for the title at any time. Clearly, we want a rematch for that, you know, as we've, you know, still got unsettled business, with Simon Marcus and Artem Levin. But Alex Pereira is doing his thing. He's staying active, and he's getting some big wins, and I think that this is important. Another win from him and another fight card in Brazil. Also, Bruno Gazzani defeats K1 veteran Wallace Lopez. It's K1 Velevan, he fought on It's Showtime a few times. Wallace Lopez, to me, he's serviceable, not the greatest guy. I want to say he fought on Glory in Los Angeles. I'm not 100% certain off the top of my head, but good win for Bruno. But really, the show and this card was really to be focused on Alex Pereira. We are going to go ahead and take this next one to Lion Fight, which is going down tomorrow. Going to give you guys your Lion Fight breakdown. We got some good fights all throughout. Let's go ahead and go with the first one, which looks like it's just going to be somebody's got to die in this fight. You know, it's this kind of fight where heat's going to be thrown. This is two guys who just stay in the pocket and let it go. Romy Adanza is going to take on Andy Housen. And Romy Adanza, of course, not the most technical Muay Thai fighter. He's not going to really come out and throw the most, you know, proficient body kicks, and he's not going to have a good, solid, consistent offensive game. Romy walks you down, and he looks for a shot that can absolutely take your head off. Andy Housen does have pretty good Muay Thai skill. He's got good skill. He could play a distance game if he wants to, but Andy ain't playing that distant game. Andy's getting in your face, and he's going to go to war. You're going to war? Lord of War is going to war. So Romy Adanza versus Andy Housen is the first fight of the night. This fight could be so good that it ruins the rest of your night. Like the next few fights, you're going to be like, all right, this is extremely disappointing. I wanted to see more people killing each other like in the first fight. That's the kind of action these guys are going to bring, unless, of course, one of them goes out before it. But, man, I'm excited about this one. It's a smaller weight class fight. We're talking about guys who weigh less than 130 pounds. It's going to be a really, really entertaining scrap where people are going to be throwing heat. And crowd, make sure you're on time for this one. It's going to be a good one. Mike Lemaire takes on Andrew Capel. Andrew Capel is a guy who fought in the... he was in a Glory tournament. He won... I want to say he won his first round fight because he's got what we... he goes low kick, high head kick. That's what Andrew Capel's game is. If you've ever seen him before, he stays long. He looks to score low kicks. Not even combination low kicks. Really single low kick, head kick. That's his game. And Mike Lemaire is a guy who he's actually got good, decent all-around skill set with his boxing and so on, but he just is inconsistent in his ability to put it together. So I'm wondering, with Andrew Capel in Full Rules Muay Thai, Andrew also fights MMA, and he's got some baffling losses in MMA to guys who you're like, man, I wouldn't have picked you to lose to that guy. And Mike Lemaire has got some moves few steps forward, few steps back type of career. And I'm wondering when he's going to develop consistency, and this might be a good fight to move in that direction. So this one, it's going to be, you know, tough to kind of pick a winner. You know, LeMaire definitely has the advantage as far as more offensive tools to score with, more offensive tools to score with. Andrew Capel, you know what you're getting with him. It just kind of comes down to who wins three of the five rounds, because I don't know if I necessarily see a stoppage here. Capel could definitely get one of those high kicks up there. But, man, it's going to be it could be entertaining scrap, but it'll be a step down after what happened with Romeo Danza and Andy Housen. Like, it'll feel like a weirder pace of a fight. Victor Saravia is going to take on Stan Mancebo. I want to say it's pronounced Mancebo. And Stan is in for what could be a tough night, because Victor, he throws heat. Combination low kicks, not a question. Not even going to throw long combination low kicks. Hook low kick with power. Cross hook low kick with power. That leg whip is for real. He's going to stay in the pocket. He's going to throw heat. Victor should win. Victor Saravia is a guy who they want to push to be one of their stars moving forward. I believe this is only his third pro fight. But, man, this guy is all action. He's got the build. He's got the look. You want this guy to be fighting on your broadcast for quite some time, as this card is one of the better lion fight cards in terms of representing the level of talent that they want the world to see that reflects their organization. Next fight is Kevin Ross versus Rongret. Sassy Papa. Rongret is skilled, definitely has everything it takes to beat Kevin Ross. Kevin Ross, of course, is going to have a size advantage. He's going to be a little bit bigger. He's going to come in with, and I'm not talking about weight, what you weigh on the scale as of weigh-in day. I'm talking about where you used to fighting, where you most comfortable fighting. A lot of times you'll see a tie will just kind of come in on, oh, this is what my walk-around weight is, and he'll fight somebody who's cutting down, you know, 15, 16 pounds. Rongrat's probably more likely going to be the guy walking in at the fight, or his weight that he walks around with, and Kevin Ross is going to be a little bit bigger. But the thing with Kevin Ross has always been offensive consistency. He has moments where he scores, and he has moments in his defense where he's watching, and then people can score big on him. That's why people love him, because he can be hit, because he's going to get cut, and he's not going to stop. He has good offense. He's got a really tricky, you know, his sweep's really cool, but his body kick to high kick, it's not like the killer high kick. It's just a high kick that comes up and scores well. Kevin Ross is a good. He's usually an all-action fighter. People are going to enjoy this performance. This should be a good fight. Lion Fight Women's Championship, Tiffany Von Soest. There's been a lot of talk, of course, for her possibly going to MMA in the sometime, you know, somewhat soon future. But she takes on Martine Kroll from Sweden, if I'm remembering correctly. Kroll, they have a similar opponent. Both of them fought Kaylee Reese. Both fought and lost to Kaylee Reese. Tiffany Von Soest, too much athleticism. Kroll's not horrible as an athlete, but she ain't Tiffany Von Soest. You have got to be a Denise Kilholtz or a Kaylee Reese to be able to keep up with Tiffany Von Soest. Very rare athlete at 125 pounds around that weight. You've got to be able to move, because she's a good size girl. Like she's got good, you know, like she played soccer, so big legs, you know, big thighs, big butt. Like the way she moves is really, really quick, and people spend most of the round just trying to figure out where she is. Her footwork is crazy too. Like, that course, people talk about her footwork, but even if she moved like a regular Thai, Tiffany Von Soest would still be quicker than the person that they are throwing at the same time. Tiffany would win. She's a superior athlete to the people who she fights, and that's kind of been the difference in all of the history of kickboxing and Muay Thai. As far as the women's game goes, the best woman is usually either the tallest or the most athletic. So that's why there's usually somebody that dominates through the history. Lucia Riker, Jermaine Durandame, those girls are superior athletes. Tiffany Von Soest in the mold of a superior athlete. That advantage, plus her, you know, spinning techniques and so on, I don't think she's going to stop Kroll, but I do really, truly believe that she should get the victory here. I want to say 4-5 at best. Malapet's going to lose to Liam Harrison. All right, that's the main event on this card. Malapet's been training a little bit more, but he still takes fights and still jokes about how he heard about his opponent. He's going to train for him on this day, or he's not going to train, or he's going to train for a couple weeks. That's who Malapet is. Liam Harrison, this is what he does. He's in the gym all the time. He works hard all the time. He likes beating Thais. This is a guy who brings over far more elite Thais than Malapet, brings them over to England, and, you know, his fights, of course, with Anuat, fights with San Chai, very close. He beat Anawat in the second fight. Liam Harrison's going to come in. He's going to stay in the pocket. He's going to get those low kicks going early. He's going to throw clean offense. The only thing that could hurt Liam is if he doesn't throw as much offense, if he plays the game a little bit too low kick, low kick, low kick. But the thing is, come rounds 3, 4, and 5, Liam Harrison's going to turn it up. And if Malapet doesn't win with something in rounds 1 and 2, I think Liam, you know, he's going to kind of pack it in. So Liam Harrison should win this fight. It's going to be a fun night. This, of the Lion Fight product this year, by far, this is the best card. So definitely make sure you take the time to get to this. DVR if you can't watch it live. It's really going to be a good one. I'm probably planning on DVRing it myself because, just the makeup of how my workday is. I've got a guy who fights in the UFC next week. I won't be able to watch it clean and, with everybody else on Twitter like I normally do. So please forgive me. Maybe some of the card, but not all of the card. But, man, I really think you guys are going to enjoy this one. It's going down. It's a really good, really high-level fight card, so I hope you like it. Going to go ahead and wrap the show up on the results of Legacy Kickboxing 3. I'm not going to bring up all the fights because really a lot of those fights are just, beginners. People just getting started, not worthy of being mentioned among international kickboxing and Muay Thai. Like, I think that some of them, I'll mention a couple because they've got, opportunities for these guys to be fighting more down the road. But as I look at this card, man, I can't stress to you enough, most of these fights are just kind of fights to kind of put on a local promotion. Sean Soriano's got a really good kickboxing style. So his stoppage of Josh Glover with the low kicks, he really went to work. Another guy who says you can score to that outside leg. He ate up the inside and the outside leg of Josh Glover. Sean Soriano, he just needs more opportunities. He had Robin van Roosmalen in his corner and, Harry Hooft. He really picked up that style. He had that style and he was able to fight with combinations and kicks in MMA. And it's tough to do it in MMA. So Sean Soriano really has a good style for kickboxing. He can't be moved slow. Josh Glover was just to kind of get it out there. Go ahead and put him in there with the guy who's competent at 145 in kickboxing. There's plenty of them out there. Get him on some of those K1 cards out in Japan. He could really make himself some money. Sean Soriano, and clearly like the Glory opportunities are there because Glory wants U.S. stars, but go ahead and make sure he's an active kickboxer at 145. He can't be treating this like his UFC contract where he fights 3 times a year. No. He's got to get this win. He's got to look to be fighting again month and a half later at the most. Got to be active. You got to get those fights in, even if they're not on TV. Next fight in the card I want to talk about, 4-man tournament. As far as technique goes, you couldn't have asked for worse as far as technique goes because these fights were sloppy. They were not technically entertaining, but man, they were club jobs, and sometimes people just want to see you go straight street. If you wanted straight street, the 209 tournament had straight street for you. Andreas von Engelen took a couple of shots from Danny Mitchell, nothing crazy. They scored, but then he scored his own big shot, and that put Danny Mitchell down, and then the count, and it was over with like 58 seconds into the fight. Andreas von Engel will move on to fight Myron Dennis in November as they wrap up this tournament. A very skilled guy, and I've known him more to be more of a combination kick guy than a KO guy, like a guy who kind of does it off work rate if you see some of his fights from Holland, but he does have the ability to, sit a guy down as shown here against Danny Mitchell. But that fight was Danny Mitchell's offense. He looked like a guy who shouldn't have been in a kickboxing match. It was not the prettiest thing in the world, but it was a KO, and the people love KO. Manny Mancha and Fernando Almeida, again, Fernando Almeida, all over him, scores it down. Mancha gets up. He scores his, 3 more downs, I want to say, in the round. There should have been three downs, and then it was over with in the first. They took it to the extra round. Manny Mancha, again, scored another down. It's funny, in his post-fight, Manny said, I don't usually have a game plan going into fights. I just start throwing stuff and something lands, good stuff happens. Or, he says, I'll get lucky. And then he also said, my coach always says technique wins. I don't think this fight showed technique by either guy. Manny Mancha's body kick looked technical when he threw it. And when he did try to throw clean and technical, I did think that he looked competent at doing it. But I thought that once it just started to go into who's going to fall, I thought Manny obliged and said, let's start throwing these things. And KO stored 2 rounds later. He will then go on to Brian Collette. He's got a tough order with Collette because Collette is a lot more patient. He's got a really good head kick. He doesn't get wild. He throws heat, but he doesn't get wild. Collette, a lot more patient. It should be a really good one from him. And then lastly, Valentina Shevchenko gets a unanimous decision victory over Anka Van Gestel. That was the main event of the card. And the thing that everybody talks about with this fight is the throws event at Valentina Shevchenko. I'm about 50-50 on the throws. There were probably five or six throws that I was fine with, and then there were five that I was clearly not fine with based off the rules. Of round one, Valentina Shevchenko comes out doing her thing. She does a Superman to a body kick that she scores a lot. She scored a spinning technique early. She was able to score well. Anka Van Gestel came out really just trying to go after that front leg. She missed it a lot. She came up with a really slow pace. Round two, I actually gave to Anka Van Gestel. I thought that she was pushing the pace, looking for setup, step-up knees. And Valentina just spent the round doing spinning stuff, not really landing it. She wasn't really able to score. Round three, again, the one spinning back kick fist landed really well for her against Anka Van Gestel. And I think that that was the decider in round three, because round three was particularly ugly. There was a lot of slams and throws and so on in there. But here is my thoughts on Valentina Shevchenko's throws. Valentina Shevchenko, it's something that goes off automatically in her head. If you try to clinch her and let's just use an example, your left arm wraps around her neck full. And then you like how you would get like in Thailand. In Thailand, they can have an arm go around the back full, and then they'll tie it up with their right arm, and they'll rest it on what would be your left shoulder. So instead of the clinch taking place with your hands being behind the neck or behind the head, it takes place with both of your hands being on the left shoulder, and you've got one arm predominantly on the back of the opponent's neck. Whenever Valentina feels someone grab that part of her neck, she spins right away. Like, even she could do it without her hands. She just spins really hard. And the moment that she spins, you fall on the ground. Because you've given up your arm to put it behind her back. So if she spins hard with the base, you're going to get tripped over. I don't think that that's illegal. In my opinion, if you do that, it's almost like you're saying this. You're required to stay in the clinch and get kneed because this person doesn't want to... they want to get their offense. And they want you to either pummel back, or they want you to not be put in the clinch at all or throw some offense. If you grab the back of her neck, if she can get you off and throwing you on the ground is one of them, as long as she doesn't do it in a tie dump style, she didn't wrap her arms around in this example, she just turns hard. Like, really watch the film. If you guys are wondering what I'm talking about, some people are still really against Valentina Shevchenko because for sure it wrecks the flow of the fight. No question about it. Even if you look at Infusion, they decided to get rid of the judo throw because they thought that it was wrecking the flow of the fight. And really only like two people were doing it. Denise Kielholz was doing it and like maybe one other person, but like, They got away from it because they thought that it wrecked the flow of the fight. But if someone's already grabbing you, you know what I'm saying, and you don't, like, go into a body lock to put them down, if you don't, you know, go into a tie sweep to put them down, are you then required as an athlete because they grab you to then allow them to knee you, or you've got to get out of it? The pummel is the only way to get out of it? They need to explain that in the back because Valentina, I'm telling you, if somebody grabs that arm around the back of their neck, as she spins, I think that's open game. That is hers to do. It's not her responsibility to just stay in the clinch. And it's not her responsibility to keep you up from falling. You can keep your balance when she spins. Not necessarily, because it's really hard. She's really skilled. But, like, I'm fine with that one. The throws that I'm not fine with are anytime somebody goes body lock, because that one's clear. You get both arms around your waist, you throw somebody to the ground, that's clear. I'm fine with the catch the leg and sweep. Even if it's illegal, I hate that that's illegal. If you catch someone's kick as a defense and you sweep them, that's their fault, all right? They got to kick harder. It's not your responsibility to not take advantage of them by catching and kicking their opposite leg. That's on them. I would prefer people let that rule go. But anytime you go body clench, anytime you step through after you catch a leg, anytime you go tie dump where you get your knee to the outside and you kind of rock the base in that direction or whatever, those are the ones that I have a problem with. I thought of her 11 or 12 that she did, I thought five of them were clearly illegal, and at some period of time, the ref should have said some kind of something. And the other part of it, I'd say, was five or six of them where someone got in behind her neck and she just decided to turn hard, and that's what got them off. I'm fine with that. So thanks for everybody who listened. Thank you for following the show. I'll try to be back next week, of course, because we got the Glory preview, and I'll try to have some guests on so we can break down those fights. I really appreciate those who've been following kickboxing. I really appreciate those who've been supporting the kickboxing and full world Muay Thai sports, and I hope that you're enjoying my podcast. Definitely support anybody who's doing any type of podcast that's really pushing out combat sports, because we really do love it, and we're hoping that you guys love it too. So thanks to everybody. God bless, and you guys have a good one. Peace.